Back in October, Aaron and I were joined by Gazan poet, writer, translator, and professor Rafat Al-Arir. On December 6th, Rafat was killed by the Israeli army in what looks like a targeted attack. The 44-year-old father of six was killed in his sister's apartment. Only his sister's apartment was bombed. The entire rest of the building was not. On today's show, I'm joined by two Gazan writers, Mohammed Shahada, a writer and analyst originally from Gaza, who is now based in Sweden. He was on the same episode that we did with Rafat back in October. I'm also joined by Youssef M. Al-Jamal, who is a Palestinian refugee from Gaza, now based in Turkey. He has been involved on numerous book projects and is also a contributor to Gaza Writes Back, which was edited by Rafat, and Light in Gaza. Mohammed joins us from Egypt for reasons you'll shortly understand. So please enjoy this special episode of Useful Idiots, where we honor the life and legacy of Rafat Al-Arir. Mohammed and Youssef, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thanks for having us.
And I'm so sorry for your loss. Can you tell us about how you got to know Rafat?
So I got to know Rafat in 2007. I was his student. I attended two of his classes and we became friends since then. We became close friends when we traveled together to Malaysia by chance. I happened to travel on the same day. Rafat also left Gaza and we were on the same plane heading to Kuala Lumpur, where Rafat took me in his house for 3 weeks because I didn't have a place. And I got to live with him for 3 weeks and I got to see, you know, another side of him as, you know, like a human being away from the formalities of a student and a teacher. He took care of me. He even gave me some money that I gave him back later because I didn't have enough money at the time. He supported me in all possible ways. And then I contributed a short story called Omar X to Gaza Writes Back, which Rifat edited in 2014. And we traveled to the United States to 8 different cities, talking about Gaza Writes Back and storytelling. So we spent a whole month together traveling. And, you know, during that time too, I also got to know Rifat more closely. And throughout the years, you know, I lived for 2 years in Malaysia. Rafat was there for about 4 years. And we also traveled throughout Malaysia together. There was the Malay translation of Gaza Writes Back. We spoke at different places and we became very close. Since then, we've been in touch. Even 3 days before he was killed, he sent me a text on WhatsApp. So he was many things to me. He was my teacher. He was my mentor. He was my friend. I have left Gaza together with Mohammed 7 years ago, almost about the same time in October 2013. And Rifat also checked on my family when I was not there. Rifat was very kind, very talented. He had a mission to tell Gaza's story to the world.
And you, Mohammed?
Well, I met Rafat through Youssef. But first, sorry about my background. As I explained earlier, I had to rush to Cairo last minute to meet some members of my family that managed to come out. And the way I met Rafat, it was through Youssef and some intellectual discussions. But the time I met him, that was around 2014-15. It was right after his home and his family's home were bombed in Operation Protective Edge by Israel. And about 30 members of his and his wife's families were killed in that war by Israeli aircrafts and ground troops. And I've seen how it changed him. But at the same time, I admired how it did not destroy him. Because to lose a home in Gaza, what it means is basically a generational effort, a generational work is completely burned down and reduced to ashes. It's people that were kicked out of their homes in the Palestinian Nakba of 1948 that laid the first brick with the little money they had, and then their children, the entire family, quite literally every single member of the family, would lay another brick on top of another brick until it turns into a home. The home in Gaza means literal generational work of every single member of the family. Anyone that can contribute would put and lay another brick on top of another. You have a median income in Gaza of $1,200 per year. That's per year. Where a house, it would be on average, it would cost maybe something about $50,000. You're talking about decades of building, just having a roof on your head, and that being completely gone. I've seen how it destroyed people in ways that are completely unspeakable. I even had a classmate whose home was bombed around the same time as Refat. And every time he came to university, he was consumed, and I would say fully understandably, he was consumed by pure rage and anger and hatred, not just to Israel, but to everyone and everything, to the Egyptians, to Hamas, to the PA, to the Europeans, the Americans, Canada, whatever country you name it, even to us, his classmates, because he would always say that every single one of you, you go back to a home with a roof on your head. I just go back and sit on a piece of rock in a tent waiting for it to be rebuilt. It never did, and it never does. And what was admirable about Refat is that after his home was bombed and 30 members of his and his wife's families were killed by Israel, he still maintained his pride, his dignity, and composure. I know he was criticized for a few instances where he said something that to a foreign audience may be interpreted as controversial. But I would say that in Refat's case, any people trying to judge a murdered man should first put themselves in his shoes and think how they would have reacted and what their lives would have looked like living only 1 week for any of those people judging and moral pandering a murdered man. It would drive them absolutely insane. By the sheer noise of Israeli predator drones on top of your head 24/7, something that Refat was very keen to highlight, this sound that gets loudest at night when you try to sleep because all noises have gone down, and Israel controls the altitude, it can bring it further down to terrorize the population. This has been the situation for the last 17 years, coupled with not having a life, no past, no present, no future, and having a population where almost everyone I know has had suicidal thoughts because of it, because of the way the situation in Gaza is. Any of those people lecturing and engaging in moral pandering about a murdered man would have not lasted a week without either bearing arms or contemplating suicide. And Refat, he didn't either. He just turned to a book. He took a pen and started writing. And that's what I find admirable about his character, is that it didn't break him down, no matter what Israel threw his way. Even in this war, when so many of his family and loved ones were being murdered, he continued to try to amplify Gaza's voice, try to speak up, and to do so while also, as Youssef said, to be caring about fellow Palestinians that he knows, friends and family. I know a friend, Rami, who wrote passionately about Refat, said that in the middle of the war, Refat went out to try to check on his office and an initiative that he built for young people in Gaza, and he sent him pictures of it, and Rami went so mad against him. He said, why would you even do that? The planes are on top of your head. You're a moving target. You could have gotten killed. And Refat even saw the guard of the building was staying around, and Refat had walked away for like maybe 10 minutes. Then he turned back and went back to the guy and gave him some money and some food. So it speaks to his character that no matter what was thrown at him and no matter how ugly and atrocious life in Gaza has been turned into under 17 years of Israeli blockade punctuated by periodic military assaults, it did not turn him into a radical. He maintained his calm, composure, and demeanor, and he maintained his productivity and creativity to be able to write poetry in Gaza, even for me. The last time I wrote a poem, although I used to do so in my childhood a lot, and when I was a teenager and early on in university, I used to compete in these sort of local competitions and win first place on the level of the West of Gaza, and in universities as well. But 2014 was the last time. That's Operation Protective Edge. It broke me, and I'm not afraid to admit it. But it did not break Refat. He continued to be productive in that way. And that I think I have to respect, even though we disagreed a lot. And even though he criticized me, and Yusuf knows that, he criticized me quite a lot in some instances where we disagreed. He didn't shy away from calling me out publicly. But I was one of the very first to go out and mourn him. I was crying when I learned the news. And every time I see his face, it's the same. I'm in total disbelief that he's gone. But I'm even more outraged at the way that he was killed and murdered in broad daylight, where everybody else is either completely silent or trying to justify it and spin it around.
You know, Rifaat presented a pure Palestinian narrative. He did not have filters. He told his own story based on his own beliefs and his own experience. Growing up in Shuja'iyah neighborhood to the east of Gaza City, their land was taken in 1948. It did not start with the Israeli siege on Gaza. Indeed, his uncle was killed under torture in Israeli jails. Rifat himself was shot 3 times during the first Palestinian Intifada. And his parents survived Israeli killing in the first Intifada too. At the same time, he lost his other uncle was also killed by Israeli gunmen at one of the kibbutz to the east of Shuja'iyah. And his brother was also killed by Israel. As Muhammad mentioned, 30 members of his extended family, and Rifat wrote about this, and his wife's family were also killed. Rifat believed in the power of storytelling, because for him, you know, as Palestinians, we have to tell our own story without filters. We're not, you know, shy from our narrative. We have a very unique narrative. And he wanted to tell this narrative to the world, that we are victims of settler colonialism. We're refugees in Gaza. We live in an open-air prison that was turned into a concentration camp, and now it's turning into an extermination camp. Rifat never shied away. And he had a great sense of humor. And sometimes his humor was very dark, because our reality in Gaza is very dark. And, you know, this is just Rifat's story, is the story of every single one in Gaza, is the story. My family, Muhammad's family, every single Palestinian, generations of Palestinians have been tortured by Israel, collectively punished. And therefore, Rifat wanted to tell his story, which is very unique and very courageous. Writing, you know, articles, poems, features, but also encouraging his students. And this is the most important thing, that his legacy is that he turned a whole generation, he gave them a pen and made them believe that they can write and tell their story away from filters, without filters. Rifat never wrote to please, you know, a Western audience. He wrote as a Palestinian from Gaza, who knows his history, his vision, and understanding of history. He was unapologetic. His dark humor also was part of our conversations when he spoke to his friends. People would sometimes think that, you know, there is an abusive relationship between these friends. Even with me, I have stories I cannot share online. We know Rifat very well. He was the, you know, the climax of human decency. Despite what happened to him, as Muhammad explained and I explained, he chose to write and to, you know, introduce Gaza to the world in a way. He created a blog in 2010, I think, 2011, one of the first blogs ever coming out of Gaza, called Gaza, This is Gaza, where he actually published If I Must Die for the First Time. So it's not a new poem, indeed. It was published almost 12 years ago on his blog, but he penned this poem to his X timeline in November. Maybe he felt like his life might be cut short because of his activism. Again, he believed in the power of narrative and storytelling, and he traveled the world, but he returned back to Gaza. He refused to leave Gaza City. He had the chance to leave Gaza, but you know, Rifat was very much attached to Gaza. He was able to be at any university in the world teaching literature with his qualifications. One of the smartest people in Gaza, in Palestine, but he chose Gaza. And he loved his students. He loved us for real, and we loved him. And that's why, see, the outrage about his killing, it's because we feel like we have been orphaned in a way.
Here's an amazing reading of his poem, If I Must Die, by the actor Brian Cox.
If I Must Die, by Rifat Alaria, November the 1st, 2023. If I must die, you must live to tell my story, to sell my things, to buy a piece of cloth and some strings. Make it white with a long tail, so that a child somewhere in Gaza, while looking heaven in the eye, awaiting his dad who left in a blaze and bid no one farewell, not even to his flesh, not even to himself, sees the kite. My kite you made flying up above, and thinks for a moment an angel is there bringing back love. If I must die, let it bring hope. Let it be a tale.
Yeah, I saw that Rifat loved Shakespeare, and one of the students joked that he put Shakespeare's novels under his pillow when he sleeps. And When he heard the joke, he laughed. He was very humble. He would sometimes even accept feedback from his own students if they correct him, which rarely happened. He was very available to everyone. He made everyone that he gave them the needed time and space to express themselves, even though he was always running and fast and busy because he had a lot of things to do. Always. He never turned anyone back. There are hundreds of students who wrote to him, who wrote articles, who translated works, and he checked their work. And, you know, he didn't have to do that. It was not part of his teaching job to do much of what he did. But then it's different when you have someone with a mission and someone who teaches for a salary. And Rifat had a mission in life, and I think he was very successful in his mission, although he lived a short life because of the barbarity of Israel. I think Israel, you know, tries to kill in us Palestinians what they do not have. They do not have someone like Rifat. Someone might say, oh, but there are also Israeli poets. Yes, we do know that. There are also Israeli writers. Yes, we know that. In fact, Rifat taught Israeli poetry in his class in Gaza, and he introduce his students to characters like Shylock in Merchants of Venice and made them sympathize with Shylock. And he wrote a poem titled I Am You, which gets into the psyche of Israeli soldiers killing Palestinians. This is Rifat. We know this very well. Israelis cannot, you know, produce someone like Rifat simply because Rifat was not living on a stolen home in Gaza.
We actually have video footage of someone at a vigil for Rifat after he was killed reading that poem that you just called, that you just referred to, I Am You.
Two steps. One, two. Look in the mirror. The horror, the horror. The butt of your M16 on my cheekbone. The yellow patch it left. The bullet-shaped scar expanding like a swastika, snaking across my face. The heartache flowing out of my eyes, dripping out of my mouth. Out of my nostrils, piercing my ears, flooding the place like it did to you 70 years ago or so. I am just you. I am your past, haunting your present and your future. I strive like you did. I fight like you did. I resist like you resisted. And for a moment, I take your tenacity as a model. Were you not holding the barrel of the gun between my two bleeding eyes? One, two. The very same gun, the very same bullet that had killed your mom and killed your dad is being used against me by you. Mark this bullet and mark it in your gun. If you sniff it, it has your and my blood. It has my present and your past. It has my present, it has your future. That's why we are twins. Same life track, same weapon, same suffering. Same facial expressions drawn on the face of the killer. Same everything, except that in your case, the victim has evolved backward into a victimizer. I tell you, I am you, except that I am not the you of now. I do not hate you. I want to help you stop hating and killing me. I tell you, the noise of your machine gun renders you deaf. The smell of the powder beats that of my blood. The sparks disfigure my facial expressions. Would you stop shooting for a moment, would you? All you have to do is close your eyes. Seeing these days blinds our hearts. So close your eyes tightly that you can see in your mind's eye. Then look into the mirror. One, two. I am you. I am your past. And killing me, you kill you.
Rifat and I visited in New York in 2014 with Rawan Yaghi as part of Gaza Rights Back. And our friend Jihad Abu Salim took us around New York City. We did some tourist stuff and we walked over the Brooklyn Bridge, and Rifat engraved the name of his town, Shija'iyah, on the bridge. He always loved Shija'iyah. In fact, he called Chicago the Shija'iyah of the United States, and he called New York the Zaytun of New York's the United States, because there's this competition also between Shija'iyah and Zaytun, the same competition we have between Chicago and New York. He enjoyed life. He brought joy to our life and to everyone who knew him. I remember how he reacted to the deep dish pizza in Chicago. Right. And like whenever we traveled, he left a great impact and memory. He made friends. He was very kind to children. I have like dozens of stories to tell from these, talks that we give in the United States, and how Rifat was able to impact people because he talked to them in universal terms. And in a way he brought, people accountable. He told them, this is our life. And we chose to write. Gaza Rights Back was Rifat's creation, like in terms of title, from the Empire Rights Back. So he wanted to tell people also that Gaza can write.
And can you guys, either Yousef or Muhammad, talk about the circumstances surrounding his murder, what we know about it?
Because I spoke to his son today, and so Rifat's apartment was bombed in October, and I think that was also another attempt at his life that he survived because of his activism on Twitter. But then he had to move to different houses and different shelters in Gaza. He went to a school, to a medical facility and a hospital. He was at Rantisio Hospital when it was raided. And he took his kids and wife, and he went to another place. He was moving around. Even when he was at the Rantisio Hospital, he wrote articles. He tweeted. He was volunteering. He was all over the place. He was very active. But eventually, he ended up in a school with his family, and he got a call from the Israeli army telling him that we know where you are and we will get you. So he left the school and he went to his sister's house in a Daraj neighborhood, and Israel targeted the house intentionally to kill Rifat on December 6th. So his brother Salah was also killed, and Salah's son was also killed, and Rifat's sister was also killed, and three of her kids. So, you know, the whole family basically like were targeted, and they were killed with Rifat. But then we ask the same question that we've been asking. Did Israel kill Rifat for real? My answer is no, because Rifat is a poem. Rifat is a word. Rifat is an article. Rifat is a novel, is a chapter in a book. Rifat is Gaza writes back. Rifat is Gaza in silence. So his words and legacy will live on. You will see Rifat in his students. There are hundreds of students that Rifat, you know, trained in Gaza. So Rifat is not gone, and we will never feel that, you know, he's gone, and we never refer to him as, you know, someone who lived and is no longer there. Rifat is immortal, and his legacy will continue to live on.
And how is his son? He had six kids.
Today I spoke with Ahmed. He has six kids, as you said, and all of them are sheltering at the same school. It was very noisy. There are a lot of people there. I just told him that Rifat's poem was translated into hundreds of languages, and people are carrying his pictures and his poem and his words all over the world, from London to Chicago to New York to Melbourne. Rifat is remembered, and there are a lot of people, like, if there is no blackout in Gaza, you would be receiving hundreds of calls. Everyone is talking about Rifat. It's been a week, but Twitter is still talking about Rifat. And this is, you know, I wanted them to know about how people reacted to this, because there is a blackout in Gaza, and they cannot tell, and they cannot watch the news. So, but again, Rifat was also, you know, a father of six, and his eldest kid is 20 probably, and it's very tragic for the family that they had to lose their father at a very young age.
No, I think he received a number of death threats from prominent Israeli sources, including from famous journalists. If you look at the screenshot that he took, it included one Israeli that was identified as a prominent journalist, and I was informed about that by some Israeli friends. But it's not only him. We've seen Rifat's story being repeated systematically throughout this war. In fact, in the first week of the war, it was one of the main targets of Israel. It was a medical doctor called Omar Ferwan. He was my neighbor. And he was bombed directly. The house itself was the target. And it was not just him that was killed. It was him, his wife, his daughters, their children, and husbands. Entire family is wiped out. Nobody left behind to pick up the bodies, which has been now the case that led to the digging of mass graves. My colleagues documented about 120 of these, either people that were not identified or entire families that were completely wiped out and gone. Now, with Rifat's targeting, it was extraordinary in a way, because the way that he was called out early on in the war in this very vicious, systematic manner, that he was immediately dehumanized and attacked for writing. You can call it a dark joke, you can call it controversial. It's up to you to comment on it the way you want.
David Afune tweeted out, "A baby was found in an oven, baked to death by Hamas terrorists." Leading Israeli first responder Eli Beer recounted to an RJC gathering last night. His group was among the first to respond to and witness the October 7th atrocities. And Rifat, quote, tweeted that, "with or without baking powder," because he was mocking what we now know, of course, and what he knew at that point was a lie. So that was his crime, right? People were more upset about his joke about a non-existent baked baby than they were about, obviously, actual thousands of babies killed by Israel. So Barry Weiss was one of those people, and she tweeted, she tweeted a screenshot of that and said, "Here's Rifat Al-Arir joking about whether or not an Israeli baby burned alive in an oven was cooked with or without baking powder." And Rifat himself tweeted out, "If I get killed by Israeli bombs or my family is harmed, I blame Barry Weiss and her likes. Many maniacal Israeli soldiers already bombing Gaza, take these lies and smear seriously, and they act upon them. And then he had a screenshot of disgusting comments like, send me your address. We're going to wipe you out in Gaza. When we get to Gaza, I personally will rape, raw dog your old mother. I'm going to expand your mom, wife, and child rectum in front of your, someone else wrote, kill yourself. Someone else wrote, you are pure Nazi, and you will end up exactly like them, rest assured.
Yes. And I think on that particular day, Refat knew that he was just a dead man walking. It was clear in his words. It was clear on his voice after. But it was also clear that he was refusing to give up until the last minute. But on that particular incident, I know a lot of people were upset about that tweet. And judging by from their comfortable seats and the safety and comfort of their homes with water, electricity, food, and everything. But I would say if you were in Gaza and you immediately saw this extremely bizarre, insane, and repulsive horror stories and propaganda thrown at you with the explicit goal of dehumanizing and justifying your murder, your reaction would not be so kind. Especially if some of these first stories were at the time debunked and called out to be unsubstantiated and unproven. So the story of the 40 beheaded babies that preceded that one, and Biden repeated it so confidently, and now we know against the advice of his own people, of his own intelligence sources, he
and
went out
and
repeated
it twice since then. Exactly. Twice since then, making a total of three times.
Yeah, I'm not sure how those people sleep at night. The only pathological explanation I have is psychopathy.
Right.
But I hope that they would at some point look themselves in the mirror. But with Biden in particular, yes, so that incident, on that particular day, I started crying uncontrollably when he said it, and I started puking. And my innards writhed in horror that this might have been a possibility. And then a few hours later, we learned that, no, he didn't have any knowledge whatsoever. He just read it in Israeli news. And then a few days later, we hear that it's unsubstantiated, and people start in the Israeli government and military start saying that this is unproven. And within a few days, we learn that it was only one baby that was killed. So after all that, to see someone throwing at you a word of a baby baked in an oven, and it was not only presented in that light. If you look at an Israeli right-wing celebrity, she's called Carolyn Glake, very close to Netanyahu. She made a video one time in 2010 mocking and celebrating the siege on Gaza, the literal starvation of children, men, and women. She made a video clip having fun with it. So the same woman, she writes that the baby was put in an oven at the same time that the mother was being systematically raped by a group of militants that shot the father in the head, and then were laughing hysterically while pointing to the mother to look at her baby being baked in an oven. That's the way that she presented it, and the way that it immediately started to fly around in Israeli circles. So to have this thrown at you, you can call Refat's reaction a dark joke, a bad joke, or controversial, but from someone in Gaza at that particular moment where his home is bombed and his loved ones are being killed, his reaction would be seen in a totally different light for anyone being in his shoes.
And it's not punishable by death, no matter what you think of it.
Precisely.
And I don't think it's a big deal. It's just dark humor about something that's used as propaganda, atrocity propaganda, like you said, to justify genocide.
Yeah, but to be on the receiving end of that propaganda, to see that being thrown at you and then a bomb thrown next to you, your reaction wouldn't be so kind.
Right.
But the other thing, another interesting tweet that Refat wrote is being used to dehumanize him. It's all the way from 2012, something where he writes that the majority of Jews are complicit in our demise, and it's only a minority that's not. And that is being used also to systematically call him out and dehumanize him. But if you look at an American journalist, Max Blumenthal, he met Refat shortly afterwards, and Max, he wrote in his own book that Refat told me this was his Malcolm X moment, because for someone in Gaza, Israel always deliberately conflates its existence and its actions with world Jews, with the Jewish population, our brothers and sisters around the world, and says that this is the Jewish state, the Jewish nation, the Jewish people defending themselves. So living in Gaza without interacting with any, this would be sort of a usual, or I wouldn't say usual, but it would be a present sentiment among some elements of society. Of course. But you can see that as soon as he met someone from outside Gaza, that changed him completely, and he was not ashamed to admit it and to have it on record. And I think it's also interesting, there's an article about Rifat in the New York Times. They wrote a feature about him that at the beginning they glorified him for teaching Hebrew Israeli poets to his classroom. And then they added an editor note because they realized that, okay, 4 years ago he taught the exact same poem, but he was not very fond of the author. He was critical of the author. And Rifat at the time, he explained to the New York Times something that I think is very genuine to his person. He said the mind can bear two conflicting thoughts. You can call this poem beautiful, or you can teach it to learn about the other side and admire the core of it or the author. But at the same time, you have the feelings of resentment or anger or rage towards that other side. So holding two opposing thoughts in one's mind is very rare these days. And as you said, no matter what, it does not justify murder. For people to take lightly a crime of murder, one of the most, if not the most single, most atrocious crime in human history, it's very insane. It's very bizarre. But to see this collective dehumanization of my entire population, my family and loved ones, to see even people that I broke bread with, people that I worked with, Israelis or Americans or Europeans, to see them expecting me to cheer and resign and accept and endorse and actively speak in favor of the demise of my own people, or otherwise I'm standing with the enemy or propagating Hamas propaganda, it's very atrocious. And it's not less atrocious than the bombs being dropped on Gaza.
Mohammed, can you tell us where you're joining from and why you're joining us from there?
So I'm basically joining from Cairo. I had to rush here last minute because my grandmother, 75 years old, managed to come out. Her home was bombed early on in the war. The home itself was bombed, so no target underneath. It was bombed from above, not anything in the bottom, not anything suspicious underneath it. And her home was completely wiped out. And so were the homes of every single member of my immediate and even extended family. I had to go and check on my distant cousins. It was the same case. And for the last 2 months, I've been worried sick about her and the rest of my family in Gaza. So she was stuck in Khan Yunis in a small apartment with about 60 people. And they basically survived off a small loaf of bread, a small piece of pita bread that they had to cut in half and eat a half every few hours. And that was the first and last meal of the day, with a little bit of thyme, spices on top, if they can find any of that. And if they can find one or two dates, that was luxury. That was basically her life for at least the last 2 months. And then she had to run again and flee. Fleeing in Gaza is now mainly done on foot. So Israel entered Khan Yunis in early December, the beginning of it, and they started kicking everyone out towards Rafah. That's the city closest to Egypt in the very south. And she had to walk all the way there to stay and sit in a tent just out in the open and without food, water, or shelter with her daughter and her daughter's husband and her grandchildren. It was very painful. And we were resigning to the fact that they may not make it alive. But she made it, her and one of her granddaughters, not the rest of the family. They are still in Gaza. So I had to basically rush here. And it's way more painful to see it in person, what this war has done to her. She basically, before the war, she was a healthy, beautiful woman. She would always wear her jewelry and Palestinian embroidery dresses all the time and be very proud of it. And she came out of Gaza basically skin on bone with her feet and legs swollen up. We're still trying to figure out a proper course of medical treatment, but the way she looked, her skin so pale and turning yellow, her eyes are gouged almost in, she looks permanently in shocked and petrified. My family's immediate impression were to tell me that you have to come immediately because she may not live that long. I hope this is not correct. I hope that she will be able to recover. But to think of all the people that are left behind in Gaza and what they are going through every single day is worse than hell. It's worse than the description of hell that we have in our tradition. And that's why I have a friend, a very close friend in Deir el-Balah, in the south of Gaza, who told me if there is a judgment day, if there's a God, if Israelis were to stand trial in God's court in the afterlife, I would ask for one punishment against the soldiers that destroyed my home and forced me out and starved me for months and months and months. That they just go out every day, forever, permanently, to look for water and food and nothing else. The pure pain and horror of their journey, especially with fighter jets bombing everywhere around you, gunfire everywhere, the smell of gunpowder and explosives, and the smoke of the rubbles, the dust of the rubbles covering up everything, that is pure hell on earth, quite literally.
Why do you think they killed him? Were they humiliated by that tweet? Did they feel like they couldn't let him get away with having tweeted that? Was it because he was publishing work, tweets in English and publishing work in English because he was teaching so many people? What is it? Because as you said, this was a targeted, as you and Muhammad have said, this was a targeted killing. In fact, they didn't bomb the whole building that his sister's family was in. They just bombed her apartment.
Rifat was killed for the same reason Hussein Kanafani was killed. Hussein Kanafani was a Palestinian novelist, very powerful, who lived for a year after Nakba in Shuja'iyya, and Shuja'iyya is Rifat's hometown. He was killed in Beirut in 1972 or 71 by an Israeli explosive. That also killed his niece because of his writings. He wrote many novels and stories, short stories, Men in the Sun. In fact, Rifat taught us his novels in Gaza when we took some classes with him. And Hussein Kanafani still lives today through his writing. So by killing, you know, a novelist, you never kill them. It's their words continue to live. And this is also the case for Rifat. His words will continue to live. Hussein Kanafani did not tweet anything. We did not have Twitter, but both Rifat and Hussein Kanafani lived in Shuja'iyya, and they had a powerful impact on people through their writings. And that's why Rifat was killed. And there are multiple journalists, dozens of journalists, intellectuals, doctors, especially doctors with rare, you know, specialties who were killed in Gaza. And it's all planned and systematic. It's not random. Israel is killing the best of us, the best of our society, the best of our intellectuals, the same as they're imprisoning the best of our people in Israeli jails, political prisoners. So it's part of caging having control over our bodies, either by, you know, imprisoning us, but if not possible, then killing us. And that's why Rifat was killed. Rifat was killed because his pen was as sharp as a sword. And Rifat was our writer, our storyteller, our poet from Gaza, and the protector of our narrative, our storyteller, Gaza's storyteller. And that's why they killed him. They didn't want us to have a story. They want their own narrative, their own narrative and the only narrative to be. And that, you know, we do not have any side of the story. And that's why they also targeted the Omari Mosque, one of the oldest in the world, that used to be a church and a temple. They're targeting Gaza's history. They targeted the archive of the municipality of Gaza. Gaza is one of the oldest cities in the world, thousands of years of history. So they're trying to erase our memory, and Rifat was part of our memory. But then, you know, in the past, Gaza was also destroyed, and reduced to rubble. And the symbol of the municipality of Gaza is the phoenix, which is a bird that lived in Arabia for hundreds of years, and it's a symbol of rising from the ashes. And they will not be able, although they might be able to reduce Gaza into rubble, and we've seen this, and Rifat actually told me in our last communication that the destruction he has seen is similar to World War II. They might be able to do that. They might destroy our homes and our lives, but then will they be able to eliminate us completely? No. Throughout history, they tried in 1948, and we remained. In Jerusalem, they're trying, and we remain. We are the majority today between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean. They could not do it in the past, and they will not be able to do it now. This genocide in Gaza will be a catastrophic PR for Israel. More people are aware of what's happening to the Palestinian people, and we will have to look at history. We are not the only people who face genocide and extermination, but we, at the end of the day, it's colonized people who live under settler colonialism who emerge victorious, not the other way around. But again, during this process, there will be assassinations and deaths and tragedies brought upon the indigenous people by the colonizers. We did not choose our occupation and settler colonialism. We grew up under occupation. We live under occupation, not above it. But, you know, despite as Palestinian novelists, they were even annoyed by the Palestine Rice Festival in Philadelphia in September. Our mere existence hurts them. And as Palestinian novelist Ibrahim Nasrallah, who attended the festival, said after in one of his novels, after all these years under occupation, we are still beautiful, as if we live above occupation, not under it.
Youssef, I know that you have lost family members. I was reading one of your stories about your sister. Can you talk about that?
I mean, what's going on in Gaza did not start on October 7. It started 75 years ago with the ethnic cleansing of Palestine and the creation of Israel and the ruin of the Palestinian people. This is a fact, and 70% of Gaza's population are refugees. And Israel has always tried to depopulate Gaza in 1967, 1969, in 1971 and 82. They always had plans, but they failed. And I hope they fail this time too. But Gaza has turned into an open-air prison over the years, especially after 2006, 2007, and Israel established a regime of permits to collectively punish Palestinians and isolate them from one another. So my mother comes from the West Bank, and because she changed her address to Gaza, she became a Gazan in Israel's eyes, and she was given a Gaza ID, and she had to give up her West Bank ID. And every time she needed to travel to the West Bank, she needed an Israeli permit. And it took her 12 years to see her family. And the same applies to Palestinian patients because of the weak health infrastructure that was rendered weak and poor because of Israel's targeting of hospitals, medical staff. People had to apply for permits to travel to Jerusalem and sometimes in the past to Israel to have treatment, because even minor surgeries are not available in Gaza. We are completely dependent on Israel. And Israel, you know, Israeli offices have this system of issuing permits and delays and rejecting people. So my sister needed a permit to have a minor surgery that was not available in Gaza. And after a week of waiting at the hospital, she got a rejection. And when she was able to leave Gaza to Egypt at the time, because of Palestinian politics, the Rafah crossing was shut down. It was too late. Once she arrived in Cairo and she had the surgery, she lost her life. And bringing her body back to Gaza was also a struggle. My aunt and dad were with her. They would, you know, drive in an ambulance and try to get her body into Gaza 50 miles every day for 2 days, and they would be sent back. And the third day, they were allowed to enter Gaza through the Israeli-controlled Kerem Shalom crossing. And as my father entered Gaza, an Israeli soldier saw him, and he was crying, and he asked him, "Why do you cry? All of us will die." You know, these are the same soldiers who caused her death by besieging Gaza. So this is, you know, our life. And even during this genocide, I also lost a dozen of my extended family. And this is the story of every, we say that my family is lucky because they did not have to relocate. They're still in the south. They did not leave their home. But again, finding food and water. And today I spoke to my mom. She was baking bread on fire when Israel bombed a nearby house, and the debris fell on her head. And my brother had to rush and take her inside. So this is their life. Bombing is everywhere, and they do not have food. They do not have access to water. Diseases are like spreading like fire among overpopulated, you know, houses. And everything is very expensive. It's sometimes 10 times the original price. A sack of flour would cost around $10 before October 7. But today, I know it's like 35 shekels. Today, you wouldn't get it for 500 shekels. That's like 15 times more than the original price. So, It's unbelievable, and it's almost like $150. That's because even in the south, there's no enough aid for people, even basic, you know, necessities. So this is the struggle of people today. It's a continuing struggle since 1948, and what Israel is doing today is a continuation of what they did in 1948. If you look at, you know, targeting water resources, trucks in Gaza today, it reminds me of poisoning water wells in 1948 to force Palestinian villagers and peasants out of their towns and villages. And they did that, and it's documented by Israeli historian Ilan Pappé. So it doesn't come as a surprise, but again, this time, because of media and coverage and social media, more people are aware of what Israel is doing in Gaza, you know, mass arrests of people. Seen it, and they're claiming that they're Palestinian militants. It's just like lies after lies. Today they published a picture of four young men with guns, as if they were like handing over their guns and surrendering to the Israeli army. And it was revealed that these were Palestinians. I mean, they did it multiple times in the past. In addition to using Palestinians as a human shields, they forced Palestinian civilians to carry guns. And one of the people who appeared in the picture published today by the Israeli army was, in fact, a trainee doctor. Another social media friend called Abdel Hakim said that the Israeli army, an Israeli officer, came to him and he told him, "I'm going to send you to heaven. I'll find you a bride there." And then he took him and he forced him to wear an explosive belt, and he put a camera on his head, and he threw him in a Hamas tunnel, because again, he used him as a human shield. And if they were like explosives, this Palestinian, poor Palestinian young man would die. And then he had to walk inside the tunnel for 40 meters before he pulled him out again. And it's on Twitter. I retweeted that. And this is what's happening to the Palestinian people. It's a continuation of ethnic cleansing.
I'm so sorry, by the way, for what has happened to your family and friends. Do you have anything else that you want to share about Rifat, the work you're doing?
I think the legacy of Rifat, we see it today in dozens of vigils organized in his memory everywhere in the world. In his writing and the reaction of people, translations of his poetry and poems, There are some trolls, paid trolls, who try to create a different legacy. And again, this is a continuation of Rifat's assassination. This is a character assassination, which is part of parcel of his actual assassination. But again, we have to remember Rifat as a person of joy. He was loved by thousands of people. And he will continue to live in the hearts of his students and the minds of his students. And we will continue to see his legacy in his writing, his articles and poems. He's everywhere in the world. If they wanted to kill Rifat, now Rifat is in at least 260 languages. His poem was translated into 260 languages at least. He's everywhere. There are many people who know him. Rifat is in New York subway, in the subway system. You find his poetry and writings, and he's on, you know, all these kites, white kites, flying over the world that he wanted to fly over Gaza, but now flying over all over the world. That's, you know, a clear example that by killing Rifat, Israel did not kill Rifat. In fact, Rifat multiplied.
Yeah, Susan Abu Hawa, the great novelist, said that. She said that when Berta Cáceres was killed in Honduras, that's what they say, she didn't die, she multiplied. And then Susan said the same about Rifat, and it's definitely true. But it's just awful that he had to not be here. If we don't want to say he was killed, let's say he's no longer, he's here, but he's not here.
He's not physically here, yeah. But he will continue to live in our hearts and minds. And we feel that he's watching over us. Every time I write an article, I feel like Rifat is editing this article. His, you know, legacy and influence is huge. And I think more people will get to know Rifat in the future. It's not just like a reaction to his killing. It's been a week and people are still talking about him and everyone wants to read what he wrote. His legacy, Rifat, will be remembered for decades and generations. And I think there is no more honorable, you know, death and killing than, you know, although it's a tragic, but then Rifat did not choose to die. He said, if I must die, meaning that if I get killed, he was a person of life, of joy. If we look at the outcome of that, is that he's everywhere now. And I think this is what he wanted, for people to tell his story and for his death to become a tale. And now it's a tale, and it's a beautiful tale that everyone is narrating. From Hawaii to Melbourne, all over the world, Rifat is remembered and is seen in his works and his students and his legacy. And I am very proud to have known him in person, but I'm proud the most that I was his student one day.
And everyone should read Yusef's writing because it's great.
I invite everyone to read Rifat's writing, Light in Gaza. He has a chapter there. He has a number of journal articles. You can find them on Google Scholar. He also edited Gaza Writes Back and Gaza and Silence, and he has a blog. Please read his writings on Mundo Wise, the Electronic Intifada, on his blog. Please spread the word about Rifat, and let's see his words all over walls, all over streets, all over the world. Let's see his kites, flying over the world. Let it be hope, let it be a tale as he wanted.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at usefulidiotpod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.